The Slums of Beverly Hills, 1979 to 1981. An inventory of my worldly possessions circa 1980. One duffel bag full of clothing, i.e. dirty laundry. One hot plate, some mismatched kitchenware, toiletries, blanket, bedsheets, and a wind-up alarm clock. Oh, and then there was the furniture. One mattress and one folding canvas director's chair. My studio apartment was 17 by 12 feet with a microscopic bathroom, toilet, shower, no tub, and the domicile's one and only sink. The sink basin was too tiny to do dishes in, so I'd have to take them with me into the shower. More than once, I washed my hair with Palmolive and my dishes with Head and Shoulders. A closet doubled as the kitchen. Technically, my address was that of a small pink stucco apartment building on Shirley Place, a street that is part of what is sometimes referred to as the slums of Beverly Hills, the ring of multi-unit dwellings that circle the more affluent residential areas. People can live in bigger apartments for less money elsewhere in the city, but they covet the 90210 zip code that Aaron Spelling's Beverly Hills High soap opera was going to make world famous. For me, at $225 a month with a six-month lease, this was paradise. Along with a new country, new city, new job, and new apartment, I'd also picked up a new identity. The Screen Actors Guild prohibits any two members from working under the same stage name, and they already had a Michael Fox on the books. My middle name is Andrew, but Andrew Fox or Andy Fox didn't cut it for me. Michael A. Fox was even worse, the word Fox having recently come into use as a synonym for attractive. It also sounded uncomfortably Canadian. Michael A. Fox? But maybe I was just being oversensitive. And then I remembered one of my favorite character actors, Michael J. Pollard. I stuck in the J and resubmitted my forms. So it said Michael J. Fox on the call sheet I picked up at Rap each night that summer, or more accurately, each morning. True to its title, Midnight Madness turned out to be an endless series of all-nighters, 6 weeks of almost exclusively night shoots. The mix of late nights and young actors gave the set a loose frat party ambiance. At least we had a few laughs, several more we correctly sensed than the audience ever would. Personally, I was just happy to be there. So what if I was working all night on a lousy project? It left my days free to audition for better ones. Determined to stay in L.A., I hit the pavement looking for future employment. By autumn, I'd landed my third post-madness project. My only disappointment was not landing a feature film. I came close on a couple of movies, most notably Ordinary People, earning a callback to see the director. But Robert Redford seemed less than impressed by my reading. He spent the audition flossing his teeth. My next big screen role would not be until 1981. The then futuristically titled Class of 1984, a teen exploitation film that would make Midnight Madness look like Casablanca. Instead, I appeared in episodes of Family, Lou Grant, and in September had begun work as a regular on Palmerstown, USA, a CBS mid-season pickup with an order for 8 one-hour episodes. With even more episodic TV work, Trapper John M.D., Here's Boomer, the odd industrial film and commercial, McDonald's, Tilex foaming tub and tile cleaner, as well as the feature film Class of 1984, my first 2.5 years in Los Angeles had amounted to a reasonably successful run. Nothing spectacular, no redwoods were felled, but I had been able to find my way to a sufficient supply of nuts and berries. During that time, I was always grateful when friends and family came to visit me, but they all expressed the same concern. While I'd taken great care of my career, I didn't seem to be taking very good care of myself. I had developed some unhealthy attitudes regarding food and shelter. Tired of wrangling with the hot plate and scrubbing pots and pans with the soap on a rope, I enlisted Ronald McDonald as my exclusive nutritionist. For any sustenance not offered on the Golden Arches menu, I improvised. Beer and cigarettes, I reasoned, must fit someplace within the four major food groups. My casual approach to housekeeping made the one-room walk-up increasingly claustrophobic. A space that small simply couldn't withstand the accumulation of domestic debris that litters a bachelor's existence. Big Mac boxes, magazines, long obsolete script pages, dirty laundry, dirty dishes, even dirty dirt. At one point, I adopted a cat for company. It turned out to be a Tom who soon left for better prospects, but not before he'd permeated the apartment with an aroma well matched to its decor.